Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Gavin Friday is an Irish singer, songwriter, composer, actor, and painter. Best known as a founding member of the post-punk group The Virgin Prunes that were active from 1977 through to 1986. After the demise of The Virgin Prunes, Gavin devoted himself to painting for a while, sharing a studio with Bono, Gucci, and Charlie Whisker. His main collaborator between 1987 and 2005 was multi-instrumentalist Maurice Caesar. The duo released a number of albums and also composed the score for the Jim Sheridan films The Boxer and In America, which was nominated for Best Original Film Score in the 2004 Ivor Novello Awards. Gavin and Bono from U2 collaborated on the soundtrack for the Jim Sheridan film In the Name of the Father, including the title track Billy Bula and You Made Me the Thief of Your Heart, which was sung by Sinead O'Connor and nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Original Song. In 2003, they wrote Time Enough for Tears, the original theme tune for Sheridan's film In America, as sung by Andrea Corr. The song was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for Best Original Song. Over the years, Gavin has collaborated with the likes of Quincy Jones, Hal Wilner, Gavin Bryars, and more. Gavin has also released a number of solo albums, including the 2024 release, Ecce Homo. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Gavin Friday.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I am in Dublin town, the capital city of Ireland, and I'm sitting here in a post-coffee, busy press time. I've just released an album, so I've been talking Gavin Friday for the last couple of weeks.
As a child or a teenager, at what age did you think, cool, you want to be in the entertainment world, and how did that journey progress to where we are today?
Let's say it was music came into my life as a 12-year-old kid via Bowie and T-Rex Bolan. And for the first time, I felt some way I was identifying with something that understood me as a teenage kid. But it was really punk when punk happened in 1976. I never thought that one could be a musician because I always saw musicians almost like in some university of godliness, like Bowie was a god in my head. But punk smashed that down, said DIY, do it yourself. If you don't know how to play an instrument, just grab it, learn it, express yourself. And it was being in the retrospective, like I was 16 in 1976, and Ireland, Dublin especially, it was a very repressed place. So punk was speaking to me in every way to be an individual. And we didn't know what we were doing, but we formed a band in 1977 called The Virgin Prunes and learned how to play our instruments and went on a magical trip that we never really thought about. We just kept going. It was like we got the keys to the car, but it was a remote control. We were just going. We didn't have a big plan. So there was no big plan.
And then when the success started to happen, because you didn't have a plan, were you guys surprised by that? Or is it just the next steps?
It was typical sort of late 70s, teenaged angst. The world is in a pretty complex place politically at the moment. Yeah. But it was in a pretty complex place then, especially coming from Ireland, because we had the troubles between Northern Ireland and Ireland and England. And we were basically under the strangulation of the Catholic Church as well. In a weird way, we were almost like in a religious dictatorship in my mind. So a lot to kick against. And when we went over to Britain first, to London, the Virgin Prunes were quite visually dramatic, didn't look like Irish. And we were sort of repelled a little by it. The Brits didn't like us. So we went to Europe. For some reason, the French, the Spanish, the Germans, the Italians, the Dutch, they just opened their doors to us. And within a matter of 2 or 3 years, we were playing to a couple of thousand a night. But as I said, we were 21, 22, 23-year-olds.
Yeah.
And this quite alternative music. We'd know sort of ambitions to have hit singles or anything like that. We had a defiant aesthetic that was just express ourselves. You know, the band didn't last long because anything that's that is that, let's say the light that burns twice as bright burns half as long. We sort of blew ourselves up because we were just so constantly wanting to change, constantly want to reinvent ourselves, and constantly going with this sort of free spirit. And eventually that does wear itself out. And 1986, we fully broke up. And it was then I really started thinking about, do I want to pursue the rest of my life in music or arts or what? And that's when I made the decision, yes, I'd like to continue in music. So it was 1986. But once again, I was not that interested in the so-called contemporary world of music. I've never walked a straight line, and I'm not a conveyor belt guy. I sort of did it my way, and I sort of, it's in the DNA, Barrett. It's like I'm just what I am. I'm sort of stubbornly me, if that makes sense, even though I'm in my 60s now.
So when you were going against the grain and you were doing things that were against the norm, did you get any resistance from that?
Absolutely. Visually, how we looked was quite, I mean, today, not as much, but if you look at photographs of the Virgin Prunes in the early 80s, you'd go, whoa, that's intense, even today. But we were questioning an awful lot. As I said, we were kicking against the pricks of organized religion, and even like sexual fluidity, which is something that's quite commonplace now. We're writing about things like that, and even about mental health, stuff that was seen quite taboo back then. And it's strange, you know, a good friend of mine, Sinead O'Connor, who passed away, she also had that mantle against the church and for mental illness. So maybe it's an Irish thing, an Irish punk thing. I don't know. But we got a hard time. I mean, physically, as a young kid and as a young man, I was to be beaten up daily was no n not an unusual thing, simply because how I looked and how I dressed back then.
So how did you keep yourself going after being confronted by that all the time?
I had confrontation as a very young kid. I was bullied a lot in school. Strangely enough, I was quite a quiet, shy little kid. I was trying to be, you know, being put in a box. And I had this resilience of like, don't tell me what to do. Don't put me in a box. And in a weird way, when punk came along, and then the fact of clothes and the way we looked, it almost became an identity slash a shield. It was a yin and a yang thing. And I came from a working class background, and Dublin in the late 70s was tough. So a smack in the head was sort of normal, no matter who you were. But if you looked like me, I'd get a smack and a kick. So let's say there's a tough skin, and that is not condoning bullying or any violence to anybody, but the world is a little more educated now. Back then, people didn't even know what ADH was or anything, you know? It was just, if you don't fit in the box, you're a fucking weirdo, you know?
You referenced the new album, so tell us more about that.
Ecce Homo, the title of the album, it's Latin. It means behold the man. It's the famous quote, it's seemingly what in the Bible, it's what Pontius Pilate said after Jesus was whipped and carried the cross and did the stations of the cross. He went to the Jews, Ecce Homo, behold the man, and they said, crucify him. Also Nietzsche, the famous philosophers, one of his biographies. It's a word. I mean, to me, even though like I kicked against the prick of religion, it's very much in my DNA. Like if you walked around my house, some of the rooms you might think I was a priest because I have so many crucifix and religious icons, but I am not a bit religious. I'm very anti-religion. But I like the fact of behold the man, here I am, this is me.
Yes.
But also, I quite like the fact that the title track came out. When I write or when I'm composing, you either write really quickly or you improvise. And when I improvise, two or three books always come as sort of touchstones where you'll jam on a word. So Shakespeare and the Bible are great things to grab onto. There's a line in Ecce Homo, fight fire with fire, which is a Shakespearean thing. And these lyrics just flew in. Fight fire with fire, we can walk on water. We will die, we will live forever. Ecce Homo. And the real thing, that the track has a pulsing anger about it.
Yes.
And the real truth is, when I was writing this song about 2018, and a certain man was the president of America, and I had this what the fuckism about what is happening, and this anger or frustration at what the way the world is suddenly from being this 21st century liberalism to far right and fundamentalism. I hate it. That's like these, we will die, we will live forever, we can walk on water. That fundamentalism, it's bad news, no matter what, where you're coming from or what religion or what belief. So I hadn't been that compelled since I was a young kid, since I was in the Virgin Prunes, kicking against the troubles in the North or the Catholic Church or Maggie Thatcher's Britain. And I felt, I can't believe I'm now in my early 60s and this shit is happening all again. It really confused me. And I think what you do is, when I'm confused and when I feel something passionately, I write about it. And I think we owe ourselves to actually stand up about anything that's far right or far left. Everything's so fucking far all the time.
Yes. Why can't we meet in the middle?
Yeah, we have to have a left and a right, like a black and a white. You have to have debates, but no one's even talking. It's just this noise each side of the world, and everyone's just commenting on social media. We're in a strange time of the world. It's a really, this is like bigger than the invention of the wheel or invention of the printing press, what's happening or what's going to come around the corner. It's a really extraordinary time. So it's obvious we're going to have to police social media. You can't just say what you think about anybody. You can't do that in a newspaper. You'll be sued, you know. But more people watch social media than newspapers. So it's the Wild West in a weird way. Do you know what I mean?
What is your perception of social media?
I find it a little primitive, as in, even though it's so sophisticated that you something can happen in Dublin and you can hear about it now in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
You know? Something incredible about the access to media so quickly. But the thing that really frightens me is the fake news. I think lockdown did a lot to fuck up everything, because suddenly all this social media had come at us in the last 10 years in a big way. And we engage, and then suddenly the world locked down for a pandemic. And everyone had time to actually scroll longer, sit in their laptops for longer. And the craziness where, like, you know, I knew some people that died of COVID, good friends. And people going, we're all waiting for the vaccine. And I know the vaccine is, it doesn't work. There's no vaccines. And I go, what do you mean it doesn't work? All the fucking scientists of the world, even the Chinese and the Russian and the Arabian and the American, all the scientists of the world are working on this. This isn't about religion. This is about science.
Yes.
It's a fucking plague. And I just saw the lies and like, but it sort of caught wildfire then, social media. It went wildfire from, you know, I've no problem with wokeism and the way people want to re-look at things, but cancel culture, I really dislike. You know, I really believe live and let live, but say what you feel. And it's just crossed wires everywhere. And that's when the talking came into shouting. Shouting at the other end of the street. You're not shouting even at the same table. It's the other end of the street. And possibly the fake news thing is what really span it out. So I don't know what to think of it. I'm afraid of it. I never liked Twitter. I think I tweeted, I joined Twitter for a week and I went, oh, get out of here. I says, I don't want this. Instagram is passive enough. I very rarely get political. You know, I would deal with aesthetics or art or what I'm working on. I very rarely get political. And Facebook, I don't understand Facebook at all. I think it's how people are believing what they read. I mean, I'm a cynic by nature. So if somebody says that vaccine doesn't work, I'd go, I'll find out about that. I'll read about it. I'll look it up. And I go, no, that's bollocks. It does work. You know, I just think people are taking things as they read them. And they're not thinking like, this could be a lunatic writing this. Do you not think that?
I totally get what you're saying. And the thing is that people are just accepting things. They're not, as you said, diving into what's actually going on.
No. And people are accepting very small things and making decisions on everything around that. I really believe the American election swung in favor of Trump because of the cost of living. People, basically, a lot of people are selfish and they see the price of eggs are now $10 where they were $4. They just want them back to be $4, but they don't realize that the fucking whole world has a cost of living problem. It's a fortune. It's like a bottle of wine has doubled. You know, everything. It's Ireland, it's England, it's Africa, it's everywhere has got it. The world is in trouble. It isn't just America, you idiots. So they sort of, oh my God. I mean, we don't want to make this about what's going to happen, but I don't think they have a clue what's going to happen to them. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. It's an interesting discussion. So why do you keep creating music? What motivates you to keep creating?
It's a very interesting question. It's in my bloodstream. I think music. The things I love are, I mean, I was called an arty bastard as a kid. I loved reading. I like painting. And I love music. And for me, they're my places where I feel fulfilled. I'm also really, I haven't performed much in many years. And I really can't wait to start going there again. Maybe I'd say, they say a lot of singers or a lot of frontmen, basically it's their subconsciously or subliminally, they really want to be loved and accepted and understood, if you want to get some Freudian aspect about it. And I think that's true, but I don't lick the ass of my audiences. You know what I mean? I don't go and sing along, clap along. I'll give them a hug. And then I'll give them a kick. You know what I mean? I tend to sort of confront it. It's just who I am. If you wanted to kill me, just put me in a house with no books, no music, and no art, and no people to talk to, and I'll die in the bed. I'll just be dead the next morning. I need them around me. I mean, in my room, you can see I have just books, and it's just my fuel.
So I love me a CD. I still buy my budget for my CDs every month because for me, I love the aesthetic of holding something. I love the journey of the choice, all those kind of things. I'm not sure if you're aware that physical CDs, vinyls and cassettes are on a massive comeback, but we've also got these streaming platforms that people consume music on. So what is your observations at the moment?
I'm like you. I'm old school. I have all my old CDs and albums, and they're my preference. I never liked cassettes, even in the 80s. I do stream, but I would stream like to find out about an album. I'd read a review and go, oh, the Cure album is supposed to be good. And I'd play it and I go, okay, wow, I quite like that track. If I like it, I buy a CD. If I love it, I'll buy the vinyl. And then sometimes you just navigate and you go, what are they talking about, this band? And I go, really? You listen to it on stream. I'm not going near that. But I'd listen to it a few times, not just a shit click once, where a lot of people just decide now. But the real truth is, there's a lack of spontaneity on streaming. If say, like, I'm in a room now with loads of CDs and albums. If I had a couple of friends over for dinner, I'd go, hey, and I'd go up to the shelf and I'd go through and I'd find an album I haven't played in maybe a year or two years, and I'd put it on. And I got, and I love this album. But if you were streaming, what you'd have to go to a playlist or you'd have to type in. So the spontaneity of accidents, you know, that physical thing of picking up the CD and going, yeah, I remember when I bought this 10 years ago, let's play it. It's that. And a great thing too, I love if you're after having a few friends over and it's you're having a whiskey and a cigarette or somebody's rolling something, take out a vinyl and you put it on and the artwork is on the table and friends are lifting up, oh, look, so-and-so plays bass on this and it was produced by this guy. And then and you see the lyrics and the artwork and suddenly in a group of five or six people are all involved in a moment about that album and its artwork and its philosophy. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 10 years, 5 hours, I know your answer will be different every time simply because there are millions of them. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to five songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those songs be and by whom?
There's a song I absolutely adore by Peggy Lee, an American jazz singer, called Is That All There Is? There's this, because David Bowie opened up the door for me. He's so many great albums. Low was one of my favorites, but The First Kiss was 5 years from Ziggy Stardust. I then would go to a song that I think is one of the most beautiful things ever written. It's Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. She's the infamous American jazz singer. And she wrote, it's the only song she ever wrote. And it's about the lynching of black people in the start of this last century. And it's powerful. I then would go to, this is where I'm a contradiction, Maria Callas, Ave Maria. Look, the sheer drama and opera of it. And then I go right back to something like Joy Division and Love Will Tear Us Apart. Because, you know, when you're an 18-year-old boy and you heard that song, it just blew my mind.
You referenced the performing live. So when is that happening?
I'm going to start touring in March and April. We got some dates set up in Europe and they're still coming in and Dublin and parts of Ireland in April. And we're going to extend that out. And then I want to carry on touring in the fall, in the autumn of that. And I hope to even get over to America at some stage. So, but it's quite complex because the cost of living.
Yeah.
And when you're a bespoke artist and you're not like a straightforward pop or rock and roll guy, and I bring quite eclectic musicians with me. So, and you make no fucking money from albums or vinyl because of streaming. It's a real challenge. But I always think where there's a will, there's got to be a way. And that was the attitude as a kid. And I'm trying to take that attitude on now as an adult.
Are you going to be motivated to record more after the tour?
Absolutely. I mean, I am the age I am. I can't leave a 13-year gap. I'd be in a bed before the next album comes out. So no, I was writing anyway. I've stuff half done. So yeah, I want to go in about a year's time and get another album out. I want to perform and release music in the next couple of years because yeah, I've got a timeline. It's called life.
Yeah, exactly. We've all got that.
yeah. You never know when it's going to end, but I'm excited about it. And I think, you know, the Irish music scene is really interesting at the moment. When there's turmoil in the world, sometimes it stirs up the arts. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It makes it interesting.
Absolutely. I totally agree. The podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
Make sure those that you surround yourself with and work with are the right people and the good people, because they're the people that are going to help you get through the shit you're going to have to get through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.